So I decided I really should go to Ephesians 1 and Ephesians 3 and just slow down a little bit and look at these just for a minute. I'm looking at the ESV. Yeah, I know it looks like a phone. And the heading there in the ESV, probably somewhere in the NIV, Thanksgiving and Prayer. So Paul says, I'm starting verse 15 in chapter 1, for this reason, because I have heard of your faith in the Lord Jesus and your love toward all the saints, I do not cease to give thanks for you, remembering you in my prayers, that the God of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of glory, may give you the spirit of wisdom and revelation and the knowledge of him. With this result, having the eyes of your heart enlightened, that you may know what is the hope to which he has called you, which are the riches of his glorious inheritance in the saints, and what is the immeasurable greatness of his power towards us who believe, according to the working of his great might, that he worked in Christ in raising from the dead, and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places, far above all rule and authority and power and dominion, and above every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in the one to come. I was going to stop reading sooner than that, but it's all one sentence, so I didn't think I should stop. But to back up just a little bit. So having the eyes of your heart and hearts enlightened, so you may know what is the hope which he's called. And then in verse 14. For this reason, I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth is named, that according to the riches of his glory, he may grant you to be strengthened with power through his Spirit in your inner being. So that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. And then there are a couple of verses that often are used as a benediction. Now to him who is able to do far more abundantly than all we ask or imagine. It says, thank you. They're amazing prayers. As a counselor who's spent part of my life in conversations with pastors and other people trying to defend the work of counselors. Because, you know, that's mental health stuff. We don't really need that. It's not very spiritual. But Paul, in both of the prayers, addresses the inner. Naturally, doesn't emphasize it as this is a weird thing. It's just, of course we think about this. Of course I pray about it. That the eyes of your heart will be enlightened, which will be strengthened in your inner being. Because it takes that, he says, in this third chapter, to be able to know what is impossible to know. And that's what he says. To know the love of Christ, the extent of it, even though that love surpasses knowledge. And it's kind of weird sentence. I'm going to read it again. May he grant you to be strengthened with power through his Spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. I can't begin to explain all that. It just helps me to remember it and be reminded of it on a regular basis. There's more to this life, and it's better to take it as a whole thing than to divide it into, well, the spiritual parts and the psychological parts and the relational parts and the whatever other parts, the work parts and the family parts and the parenting parts and all of that. God wants us to be people with each other, whatever those roles are that we have. And that's what he intended to do. And Paul is helping us recognize and reminding us that we need to be continually strengthened inside out, through and through, by God, so we can be grounded in that, so that we can carry on, knowing we can enter into our relationships with each other if we just stick with that example. Because if we have our eyes open and trying to focus on that other one and trying to look for, including what's going on there in our life, and paying attention to our own as we're doing that, that something can happen that's beyond knowledge. Nobody can write a book or post a blog on a website or do research or whatever to explain and predict and all those kinds of ideas of knowing what you can learn about a human person and yourself in this relationship that you have. I think that's all I'm saying. I'm going to try to restrain myself. Just do a couple of things. I'm going to look at what I said I was going to do in part three, which is now. Oliver is making his presence known. Did someone get a chance to walk around? At some point, I took a little bit of a walk, not too far. Ran into a couple of you as you were heading up from the beach and I was heading down to the beach. I didn't go all the way. Every step down, I realized I don't have to go back up. And finally, I hit a place where, oh, that's enough up. I can't do any more down. One of the things that so I was walking around, there are some cabins on the other side, that way, that look a little bit like log cabins. And for some reason, they sparked, I just pointed in the wrong direction, they sparked a memory. And I think I have this pegged, and some of the details don't fit together right, but this is a fragment of a memory. Pretty sure it was the vacation trip, which didn't happen very often in our family. We didn't have a lot of money. My dad was still alive. So I'm going to say I was four. That was in 1957. This is the part that doesn't quite make sense, but my memory is that I know this part's true, but I don't know if it was true for this trip. My dad somewhere borrowed or rented or obtained one of those one-wheeled pop-up trailers. Oh, most of you don't even know what I'm talking about. But it was a little trailer, and yeah, maybe they had two. I think this one had one right in the middle. And a tent would pop up on top. And so my dad was pulling this thing. And we went from Madison, Wisconsin to West Virginia. My mother's from West Virginia. Maybe that's why we're headed to West Virginia. And this is not the, I remember this memory very clearly for a long time, just the riding in the car in these mountain roads, two-lane mountain roads, dad's pulling that trailer. And I couldn't see the road. I'm a little kid looking out the window and all I can see is down. And I was really scared. I remember that piece. But when I saw the cabins, I'm like, I remember when we used to stay. Rarely, it happened very few. I only remember one time, but it might have been twice. I don't know. We used to stay in these motels, or maybe there was a different labeling, where it was made up. It was cabins. So you went to the main office, and then they gave you a cabin number, and you drove up to it, and you went in. And I had this memory of how excited I was. It was probably a four-year-old to be in this place. And a lot of that would have been It's new, it's an adventure, and it wasn't scary because the context was my mom, my dad, my brothers. And it was, and I just walked by the cabin. I started to feel that. I wouldn't know. I don't have that memory very often. And so that would be for 58 years since then. It made me think a little bit of your, what's your little guy's first name? Jude. It's a breakfast. And what's he going to remember? Some of you have older kids. My kid's 30 and 34. It's shocking to me what they remember and what they remember as significant. When you put all of this effort in and all of this stuff, and you know, you can say, oh, there are going to be a lot of things. And Bethany and my youngest, but she's asked this two or three times in the last couple of years for some reason. So, Dad, you know, one of the memories I have the most is at Covenant Church. Yeah, they're all Covenant Church. Covenant Church in St. Louis when I was little, and you would draw. I am not an artist. And you know, it would look like childlike drawings. Maybe that's why she remembers it. I don't know. And you would draw. I'm sure you were just trying to keep it quiet. But for some reason, it was so, I think she felt focused on it. I think she felt like, I have all of that. And now as a 30-year-old person, for whatever reason, I don't know what, she has brought that up a couple of times as one of her, she didn't use this word, but it's really what I'm getting, her cherished memory. It was a relational. It was safe. Just like that little motel, whatever they called them then. There's a name for it. It's almost there. But it's, if I keep talking about it, it might come, but it'll take too long. Yeah, it was a relational moment, actually. Yeah, I looked like a 4-year-old kid, probably excited. Ooh, look at this school. I'm running around. I can't, you know, kind of remember that. Wow, there's a bathroom. That was like a big deal. But it's not what was there as much as who was there. Which I'm hoping sets us up to look at. This is toward the back of your packet. The very last set of pages. See where I am. So that last page that has the name of the book on it. You go in, that's 185. I want to start at 171. One of the things I hope you see is Johnson's here is talking about this conversation five. She talks about them in their seven conversations format. Content's different, but in a very real sense, the process is the same. It doesn't change that much, and hopefully that's so there, 171, I have it underlined, that sentence in that second paragraph on the page. The first goal for partners is forgiveness. Just as with love, forgiveness has only recently become a topic of study. Most scholars speak of forgiveness as a moral decision. Letting go of resentment, absolving a person's bad conduct is the right and good thing to do, but this decision alone will not restore faith in the injured person in the relationship. And it will not restore trust. She's right. What partners need is a special type of healing conversation that fosters not just forgiveness, but the willingness to trust again. Renewed trust is the ultimate goal. That is a profound, profound curve. Like I said before, I've lived in the church all my life. And that means that I've been not in the church. I've been betrayed.
First
and know that the usual way that someone, you know, a friend's going to come alongside is, in church setting, is pretty soon they're going to remind us that we really need to do this. I'm thinking of a specific situation. And when my friend Paul came and said that, and when he said it, I knew he was exactly right. And this was about, you know, a week into a hard situation. And I think I probably said to him, you know, I've been trying to do that. And you're right. That's a good one. And I continued to try to do that for about 3 years, maybe two, and ended up moving from that city where that situation had happened, and so did this other person. I should be a little clearer. The other person was the senior pastor in the church, and obviously he's an assistant pastor. Actually, I was an assistant to the pastor. That's his technical stuff. But it makes a big difference sometimes, because what that meant was, you know, an assistant pastor is hired by the session. I think I'm remembering that. Assistant to the pastor is hired by the pastor. I mean, the only reason you're there is because it's pastor. Associate pastor, no. Congregation, you're there because of the congregation. That's a whole lot more secure. Well, this senior pastor who brought me there as his assistant too, while I worked coordination and other things. He resigned. Okay, well, I mean, no, those things happen. But he didn't tell me. and there was a meeting there. And it was, we normally got together to talk about just finalize what we're going to do in worship that morning. Walk in his office on a Sunday morning, and I walked in that morning and knocked, and all these people in his room, and he excused me. Strange, I don't know what's going on. And went into the church service. Some woman who was in the know knew what had just happened. He had told the session he was going to. And she was in tears. Wonder what's going on. People after church were saying, "Oh, we're so sorry. Thank you." They weren't able, didn't think they really should say why they were sorry. So I just left it there, but, And about 2 o'clock that afternoon, my friend Paul called. And I'm like, okay, Paul, and he said, and he explained. See, Pastor resigned. I kind of thought it was probably something like that. And he's like, you didn't know? He said, no. And about 7 or 8 that night, Senior Pastor told me what's going on. I think this is the last time I ever heard a conversation. Just for a long time. And it was a big, big hurt. It was a really, really big hurt. So now I'm sitting with Paul, and it's like, yeah, you're right. I'm saying all that to say there are other things that need to happen often for forgiveness to really happen. Sue Johnson has managed to actually, her process that she described to capture those things. She has 6 steps. But that feels like a couple steps too many. But in those steps, she really captured something that we've often missed in our circles. And as a counselor, I think of it this way, is if we really need to do some sort of grieving process around the loss. I'm jumped to somebody died. You know, what's lost in this offense, betrayal, whatever it might be. And there were multiple losses in this. He resigned without telling me. Loss in relationship and the care that I thought I had really with him and my job. There were multiple losses. And you know, in a grieving process, when we get assaulted with some kind of blow like that, initially, we really sort of dissociate from it. There's a denial. which is a good thing. God works it in such a way that we can keep functioning even though our world in a certain way fell apart, so that we can stay there. But gradually we move through these things where we start to get a hold of what do we feel more around the stuff that happened. And we need to be able to do that before we really move into a deeper forgiveness. If we don't, we're really not very aware of what it is that we actually have to forgive somebody. I mean, initially with this man and that was the senior pastor, I didn't really know. And it took a good long time to get to the place of, okay, and name it. So let's flip the page. Before you do that, so that sentence in the middle, but this decision alone will not restore faith in the injured person and the relationship. A special type of healing conversation. So 173, six steps. Number one, the hurt partner needs to speak his or her pain as openly and simply as possible. So we're talking about a conversation, not in the midst of a intensity of the raw, harder emotions, but in another place where it's maybe the one who's done the hurting said, I need to hear more. I understand the hurt, but I'm ready to listen. And that her partner needs to be able to say, here it is. And relay that as much as possible. The second step, and I have a little book page marker there that got folded over. The injuring partner, I'm not sure what that word is, stays present and acknowledges the wounded partner's pain and his or her part in it.
Emotionally.
Listens, but it's more than hears the facts. Okay. Step three. Partners start reversing the never again victim. I'm not sure how clear that is. But often what happens when we've hurt each other, especially if it's big stuff or it's repetitive, is we can end up making these vows of, I'm not going to let this hurt me, or I'm not going to let you hurt me anymore. They take different shapes. This is really, I was deciding to not be vulnerable anymore. I'm going to try to counter that. We're going to try to counter that together. We're really going to try to stay open to each other. There's some wisdom in that. There's wisdom in what Sujata's saying, recognizing that sometimes we can be going through the steps of forgiveness, but we've really walled ourselves off. And so we're not really doing much of anything. Sometimes that's what apologies actually are. We're saying, I'm sorry for that. But we really haven't connected to it too much. We've decided to keep some distance and not get hurt again. And therefore, we can't do the next step, which is injuring partners, that's the one who did the hurting, now take ownership of how they inflicted this injury on their lover and express regret and remorse. If you're going to express the remorse, you have to be feeling. If you're really stuck in the, I'm going to do my best to not get hurt, you're not going to feel that remorse. You're not going to feel the regret of, oh, wow, I really hurt my wife. I don't want to do that. That usually is the missing, often is a missing piece in forgiveness processes, whether it's marriage or other kinds of things. The one who's done the injury to actually get to the place where they get what they've done, and they do something of a, oh my goodness, what have I done? It takes some time, it takes some courage, and
And it takes a process.
It's a portal to the moving forward. It takes some listening to that actually. The next page over here, 177, that first paragraph, they're talking about a situation. I think we can just read this paragraph. Vera is obviously very moved by Ted's apology. What does he do that is so effective here? First, his manner makes it clear that he feels and cares about Vera's opinion. Second, he explicitly tells her that her hurt and her anger. Affirms. It makes sense to judge. Those of you in the room who are rational, defensive, you know, more of the defensive nature than the attack nature, maybe kind of a thing. Defense can, yeah, defense is more.
Whoa. That's not what I meant.
Excuse me. The second one's going to be very difficult for us. I'm in that camp. When I'm saying to Carol Ann, no, what I was trying to say was this, my effort to clarify, because my belief, it's a foolishness, but my belief is, if you understand what I meant, then it won't hurt anymore. But even if she does understand what I actually meant, it still hurts. But I always forget that. And I'm rational, and I tend to go that. Another thing, and I don't like saying this, I never think about it, I didn't think about it until I read this again, but I'm actually doing with that as I'm saying, your hurt and anger are not legitimate. I've lived a lot of my married life, especially in the early, first 20 years, basically saying, no, you shouldn't be angry right now. I don't do that. That's not what I did. So there's a lot loaded. And what she's saying. Okay, so first, makes it clear he feels and cares. Second, explicitly tells her her hurt and anger are legitimate. Third, owns up to exactly what he did that was so hurtful. Another thing I was not doing. Fourth, expresses shame. He tells his wife that he feels too dismayed and disappointed by his behavior. Fifth, he reassures her that he will now be there. Fifth step, hold me tight conversation not take place, where it's like, what do I need from you? You're repositioned at the place where now we can be vulnerable to each other. Because the one who's done the hurting has not necessarily taken away the sting, but they've helped explain, I don't want to be that way and I want to be involved with my parents. So now we can have a conversation that's more reparative by saying, okay, listen to me, this is what. This is what I'm afraid of. Maybe response, maybe part of our fear is going to be, you know, for me, I could be saying, I'm afraid I'm going to fall into my default of being too rational, of being defensive, trying to keep myself looking good, rather than and miss you. I don't want to miss you. Can you at least try to remember I don't want to miss you? And when I am, do something. Help me to in that process. The sixth one is the couple now create a new story that captures the injury event, how it happened, eroded trust and connection and shaped theme of dialogue. I don't know exactly what she's meaning there. I think I have an idea about it. It's related to the idea of this is for all the things that she's been talking about, of trying to get our sights sort of stepping back from the episode that we're currently in and trying to see it in the context of our whole story, our whole relationship. So as you all think about, so what are the patterns that we get into that are negative and create disconnection? The point isn't a specific incident, it's not so much a specific pattern. In a sense, it's more the bigger story of we love each other, we want to be connected, we do these things sometimes that erode that disconnection. So how can we view that as an aberration in terms of who we are, but it doesn't define our relationship? We keep it in its place. One person He's the only one I've ever really heard say this, and it's so brilliant, the wise man, Ed Friedman. Sometimes the problem we have isn't the problem, it's how serious we are about it. We blow it up and actually give it more power by our over-seriousness and our over-concern and our anticipation of what this is going to mean for our future, that our future is forever darker than it would have been because of this thing. And it's just not really like that. There can be very dark things happen, but your life isn't over. And they are just one thing, no matter how dark and how bright they are, in a very big and long story. And as long as we can remember that, it keeps us in a different place, and it helps us stay connected so that almost externalizes those issues and those problems. It's not something between us and our problem as much as it's something out there that we together are going to work with and against and for. So that to keep it what it is.
It seems like there's also a component of restoration in this process also. Defending party is in terms of let's step back from this, let's look at this and find victory in this, not just because you don't want to injure me anymore, but because I've forgiven you, I've recognized you as important to me, and there's this moment, this argument or whatever has been redeemed. Our relationship is stronger on both sides now. We've had this conversation, we've come out the other side of it. Our relationship, because without that, it's just a sort of an acknowledgement, and then there's no discussion or a characterization of the argument or whatever the issue was as a victory. Then the person that is always wondering, are we healed? Are we gone? Am I still paying for this?
Good. Other thoughts, questions?